Yesterday, we got into the, her concept of work, we started with that, and we looked at the treadmill. We talked a bit about what that, if that even looked familiar to us. And some said no, and some said yes. She had been, her, the title of that chapter is Work and Alienation, and about the meaninglessness of a lot of the things that people do and call it work. I mean, are forced to do in a sense, and it's called work. And it's the alienation from themselves and from each other, and a sense of self-image and self-worth that doesn't come through in the kinds of things, the way in which work is set up for a vast majority of people. One of the things I didn't say yesterday, she talked about herself and saying that she really likes her work. There are some parts of her work that she doesn't like to do, but we all have those kinds of things. But she has some choices as to when she's going to do those things that she doesn't particularly like to do. And I think a good portion, perhaps, of those of us who are here also have that in our work, that we have chosen a field to be in, and it feels really okay. And there's just some things, like for me, it's, I was going to say, it's meetings.
Yes.
No, that's basically what it is for me, that I do. I don't like to get involved in the congregation and lots of programming. And when that happens, you know, I just feel like, oh, here goes another one. It's, you know, another night. And nothing, not a real sense of productivity or a sense of participation. So that would be kind of how. And we also talked about her concept of sin. And today, on the more positive note, her chapters on work and on love and sexuality, and then her final chapter, which is on We're Created for Hope. What I thought I would do is just give the chapters, the titles of the work chapters, and say a little bit about each one. Work as self-expression. Whoops. Sure.
Good try.
One more shot. Good long age. Work as and social relatedness, work as reconciliation with nature, in regards to the first one, work as self-expression. She talks about work as a real basic human need. And what has happened to that is that our understanding of work has been marred by division of labor, that we have, we're so compartmentalized. And she cites two. One is a Catholic encyclical, and the other is an example of a nation that has done some good things in terms of work. And the nation is Yugoslavia. And when she said, you know, whenever the revolution was there, or whenever the new form of government came into being, it didn't seem to be working. It's a socialist system, but it's not... What would her word be? It would be state. It's state socialism, but it's not there's more cooperation between the workers and the state than there is in any other concept of state socialism. In Poland, in their solidarity movement, that's been the primary issue there, is the workers wanting more control over their lives and their livelihood. The other is the Pope John Paul's encyclical Laborum Exercens. Can I ask you, is that right? How do you say that? Laborum?
Pulse.
How would you say it? Exercens? E-X-E-R-C-E-N-S.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a theology of work. And essentially what the encyclical says is that labor has priority over capital. And what I'd like to just do is share a little bit about that and then say, how does this sound? It says, the theological foundation of the encyclical is the understanding of the human being as a worker. God has created people to be creators and to realize their humanity through work. The human being actualizes herself, becomes the subject she is meant to be, becomes truly herself through work. In good work, we discover who we are. We assume responsibility for ourselves and others, and we lay the foundations for our own future and society's future. And the encyclical has two sides, a subjective and an objective. The objective refers to the product of the labor and the sense that we need to produce for our needs, but that technology should be our ally instead of our enemy. And the encyclical states this. It's technology facilitates work. It perfects, accelerates, and augments it. It leads to an increase in the quantity of things produced by work, and in many cases improves their quality. However, it is also a fact that in some instances, technology can cease to be man's ally and become almost his enemy, as when the mechanization of work supplants him, taking away all personal satisfaction and the incentive to creativity and responsibility, when it deprives many workers of their previous employment, or when through exalting the machine, it reduces humanity to the status of its slave.
I'm thinking, too, that it takes away sometimes a sense of finishedness. To just put on a door on a car, you don't get to see the finished product.
Right. Or if you fill, if you're on an assembly line that fills something, you know, and you're just one who puts the object in, but you don't even get to see the can.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you don't even do that anymore. Because the machine, you just start it out, and the machine puts everything in and seals it and sends it off, and you take it and put it on a truck.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not that sense of being in from the beginning to the end, the finished product, which I believe was true prior to the mechanization of, we had the skilled technicians. Yeah.
They get around that Volvo, for example, I think it was one of the first ones and probably the most important company. They've got their work crews so arranged that they follow the unit through.
Wow. Now that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. That way they get to see. Plus they have an investment. You know, then they're more, that's maybe why their cars are so good and last forever. Yeah. The encyclical also, or the Pope's, she said, speaks about the gospel of work, which is a wonderful term, I think, saying that the fact that the one who, while being God, became like us in all things, devoted most of the years of his life on earth to manual work at the carpenter's bench. That as Christians, we have at least in our New Testament scriptures the understanding that there is no hierarchy of labor. You know, that Jesus was a carpenter. And my understanding, I may be wrong, we don't have a whole lot of information between the age of 12 and the age of 30. My guess is a good part of those years was spent working as a carpenter. And the people that Jesus chose to be his disciples were primarily fishermen, low management, persons, that they were all the people who were what we would say are at the bottom, the laborers, the ones who don't count as much as the management. So we have that example.
In what sense do we say they don't count as much?
Well, this is me, not Dorothy Zola, but my sense is that we are valued by the amount of money we make, by the type of job we have, and by our position.
See, I don't see that in this world that I live in.
Oh, you don't?
No.
I certainly have experienced that. I've experienced that as a woman.
Sure.
And my experience in that is that, I don't know if this is fair, it isn't fair to all the clergy in Minnesota, but when I was in the church, before I became a pastor, I was a teacher once, and I didn't experience it as a teacher, the separation of labor, you know, as a teacher and as a woman, I didn't experience that. I was somewhat oppressed, okay, because there was pretty much a mutuality there. But I started to work for the church as a secretary and as a parish worker. That was my first job outside of teaching. Most people saw me more as the secretary, and I'm not a secretary. I can't do that very well. And when somebody finally came in who could be a secretary and was good at it, the bulletins looked better. I used to type them upside down, run them off upside down and backwards. It's real interesting for the congregation on Sunday morning to try to figure out where. Okay, I was treated differently, I was paid less, and my job was eliminated in that congregation so that the congregation could call a second pastor to do the same things that I had been doing.
Sure, there's lots of examples of it, but you stated as a generality. That's what I deny.
I can only speak, I am speaking from my own experience, but I know that in most cases, when I share this, I hear a lot of other people who have the same experience. When I became a pastor, people treated me differently.
Yeah.
And that is wrong. That is wrong.
Well, I like what you're saying. Would you explain a little bit more what you're saying?
I think that parts of what you say, we do pay according to certain things that people do.
Mm-hmm.
In some areas, the garbage collectors get paid more than the school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And a variety of other things. But I see in the environment in the community in which I live and have lived,
mm-hmm.
that what people do, let's say 40 hours a week at their work, has little to do with their regard in which they are held by their neighbors, by the other people in the church, by their position on church council,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know what else to name.
Mm-hmm. That
there is the opportunity for people from whatever work background almost to participate in various phases in the political, in the economic, maybe limited, but in the economic, and I guess I see in all sectors of life as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not stating a universality, but I'm using it as a denial of your statement of a generality.
Okay. That's probably true. I guess my sense is that my experience has been the opposite, because I've worked primarily inner city and labor-intensive communities where that isn't true. What I'm hearing you say has not happened for those people.
It's sort of hopeful for me when you say that. It gives me a sense of hope, because it hasn't been my experience either, but if it is indeed happening in the community that you live in, that's really impressive.
That's where it is.
It's a whole issue of comparable worth that's in the center right now.
I see that happening a bit, but I see the other side of it a great deal too. For instance, I have a problem. I wasn't ordained until I was, how old was I? 46, I guess. And I would much rather be called by my name rather than pastor. Or maybe pastor, very fine. But I'd also like to be able to to relate to a person as another person, on equals. And sometimes it's hard to do.
Yeah.
But more than that, I come from a very rural community. And oftentimes a man's worth is valued by how much wealth he's been able to accumulate.
Yeah.
I see it, I was a teacher one time, and I could see, depending upon which school you got put in, your value, like the stock market, would fluctuate depending on which school you got put in. I was very fortunate. I got into the largest school system in the state of Nebraska. But I happened to know somebody that knew me on board. Put me in the best school. I mean, I had no reason in the world to be put there, really.
Yeah.
But because of that, I was, I guess, rated as one, having, for some reason, some qualification over another, which I didn't have. I know I didn't.
See, to me, that, and I recognize there's much of this. To me, this is many of the inequalities in life. And I know there's lots of them out there. But I think that there are lots of opportunities, too. I've seen the discrimination against various people. But it seems to me that there's vast opportunities, too.
My sense in what each of you are saying, all four of you actually, is that it really depends upon what your perspective of life is. In fact, I operate a lot with images. When you were speaking, Sue, I pictured myself back in the Hispanic community in inner city Milwaukee, feeling how discriminated against those Hispanics were working in the tanneries, which no white male wanted to work in,
right. And
probably wouldn't. And now the INS and the Immunization Services came in and said, you can't hire these people because they're not citizens of the U.S. When you spoke, I imagined myself in Sturgeon Bay, where I grew up, a white middle-class community. Everybody had an opportunity for a job. When you spoke, I imagined myself in my uncle's neighborhood, which was rural, and some people had breaks and some people didn't. Some people were perfectly happy working in those communities the rest of their lives. So it really depends on what your perspective of life is as to what your definition of work will be. I read this week in the paper on the way here on the train that it's more important for people to experience a sense of independence and a sense of responsibility in their work than how much they make. And I guess if a poor Hispanic works in a tannery and feels good about himself or herself, it doesn't matter how much they make or what position of responsibility they have. And my uncle on the farm is very happy to be a farmer. It would drive me crazy.
So then you go to the other part of it, the popularity also. Dictates salary a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the cover of People magazine some time ago showing the salaries of President Reagan, Michael Jackson,
sure. And
these people. And then you also think of the football players
at
the salaries that they get, the basketball players.
Right.
This becomes the popularity aspect that
creates the
salary.
So rather than, I think, to polarize ourselves, which I've sensed could happen here this morning, and saying, well, I deny or anything. My feeling is, well, let's each of us come up with our own definition of work.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, John Paul has one, she has another, you have yours, we each have our own. And then let's celebrate that. Let's be grateful for that.
And I would agree with that up to a point, but for the fact that oppression is a result of a result of the generalization, perhaps. If we are only considering celebrating, our own definitions, then what do we do about the people who may want to move from one place to another place in their understanding, but can't, because there are certain limitations that are set arbitrarily or superficially for them.
See, I'd agree there's a need. There is a need for the opportunity to move.
Yeah. But But also, do you see, are we saying, are you saying that it's okay to have the, that we move up?
I said move.
I'm wondering now, are you also saying move up?
Move wherever they want to.
Yeah.
Or move someplace else that they want to. I don't mean wherever they want to. Mm-hmm. But that people do have some choices.
Mm-hmm.
And that we move towards lessening of the inequalities of opportunity, mm-hmm. inequalities of resources. But I'm trying to say that it ain't that bad a world we live in. No, I do sense some difference in perspective. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I guess I would rather we look at it as inequalities, but less than generalizations.
Okay.
I see a great leveling off, though. On the one hand, for instance, like what my parents knew, or what I knew as a child, especially what my parents knew, the interaction in communities, whether it was in rural or where it should be in urban, the position of say the lawyer, and the clergyman, and the banker, and the doctor. Well, the doctor wasn't very high. Until probably when?
Late 1920s.
Thirties and forties. Yeah, so in the '40s probably. Huh. It really grew. But the banker in particular probably, and the clergyman.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they held power.
Yeah. And occasionally so did the teachers.
Yeah. Like in Tanzania.
Yeah.
20 years ago. Not today.
Right.
The bottom
rung. Yeah.
It sounds like what you said before is, as a clergy person, that you don't necessarily want that kind of power. You want to be seen as a human being called by your first name instead of pastor, such and such.
I accept my role. I think there are places where it's good for them. I mean, good for people to recognize, say, that if I can be their spiritual leader, mm-hmm. that they feel free to call me pastor.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I want to be able to relate to them that I can be just a person, another person to them, and really with them that way too.
Yeah.
Because if it's always on a pastor and a client relationship, it can be pretty sterile or awful stiff.
And also, your own needs don't get met. Mine don't,
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
that
what
respect.
What do you turn to when you are,
Yeah. And the hard part is knowing sometimes where that line needs to be, you know, when somebody in that relationship, only because by just being, sometimes, well, I don't know. I have to struggle with that too. It's a real issue for me.
I think you're raising one of the most fundamental issues here for us. And I think the reason that there's so much sharing this morning is that, you know, you're touching on a very fundamental part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about a person's sexuality or their work.
That's right.
It can be real threatening if you come up with a definition, or she comes up with a definition, a generalization of what work is, which John Paul happens to do too much, and then you can really feel threatened by that.
But I do think that, I mean, I guess there's a real sense that we do need work as a means of self-expression.
Right.
And I don't know how anybody could disagree with that, and I have a hard time with people who might. As a means of saying who we are. And it's not so much what we do, but that we do it.
I heard stated at one point what we need as human beings is someone to love, something to hope for, and work to do.
Yeah.
Without work, how can you express, or how can you be creative in any way? That is, even to draw a picture, in a sense, it's work, and to work with wood, to build a house. But if the only thing you do is put on the shingles, maybe, and never anything else, it's somewhat less unless you make designs with the shingles.
It occurs to me that part of the changes today in terms of parenting and mothering is that parenting for so long has not been considered important work.
Mm-hmm.
So mothers for so long felt like they didn't have that creative outlet of work to do when indeed they were doing the most important job in the whole world. But for society not to see it as important work, you know, then what is my work if I'm not kids?
And constantly hearing women refer to themselves as just a housewife. I am nothing. I am just a housewife. And I think, what do you mean, just? That's work. And it's good work. And it's probably the work that is, from my sitting back and looking at it, the most self-expressive work.
Talk
homemaking, not housewifery, because there is no such thing as a housewife. But a homemaker, or as one of my friends called herself, some kind of an engineer. What was it? Domestic engineer.
Talk about seeing, you know, child raising, seeing something through from beginning to end.
Right.
There it is.
And not just the child raising, but the creativeness of making a home livable. I mean, a home being not the house even, but the family, creating an environment in which all the participants feel a part of it, you know, and maintaining that kind of environment, that seems to me to be a real task. But it's a very self-fulfilling kind of thing too. It can be, but again, as long as it's affirmed.
That's the word, affirmed.
Yeah, and if, you know, people who've been homemakers for years haven't felt very affirmed in that role. And one of the arguments has been, that I've heard, is we don't get paid for it.
Well, it's the government recognizing human.
That's right, you don't get Social Security for it.
So the poorest people in the United States are widows up in their 70s and 80s because there is no provision for that.
And single mothers.
That's an important
point. And single mothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there, you see, you can say a lot, but in reality, it really is not so. You can say it's the greatest thing in the whole world, but in reality, it isn't, because those people have become prisoners to the monetary system.
Yeah, we live in a capitalistic system, so you have to have a job to survive, really, or go on welfare.
Or in some cases, I used to argue with women and men in the community that I was in, where the man was the one who worked outside the home and the woman worked inside the home, right? That's how I understand marriage. If one chooses to stay home and be the homemaker and the other one chooses to work outside the home. But the person in the home never saw the money that was made by the person outside the home as her own. I shouldn't say never, that's a generalization, but quite often had the sense that that's his money and I don't have any. And my argument is that's a partnership, and that the money that is made outside the home is essentially, both of them are working for that money. But that was a concept that was so hard to convey. Now, does that make sense?
Yes.
Does my point make sense? That
it's like what she's doing in the home makes it possible for him to go out and work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And in a sense, he needs, one of them needs to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If they want a family, if they want a unit.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But even if they are a unit as a couple, one of them has to work if they're going to eat outside the home. One has to work outside the home if they're going to eat, if they're going to make their house payments, if they're going to drive a car.
But that's even changed because, what is it, 60% or 60, more than 60% do both.
Yes, but my sense is that part of the reason why that has evolved is our economy. The other part is because of the value placed on the money.
Or fear of what's going to be for you in the future if they've seen their mother or their grandmother or an aunt and they're frightened.
Yeah.
How about the setting in which we live? I think now where I grew up, if you lived in the home, you still had, you know, you had a lot of space. What are you in an urban area where you're in a little apartment someplace? You will start raving mad in a hurry.
Yeah.
Yeah, with all these appliances doing everything for you, you don't need to be there.
The hardest thing you can do sometimes is push a button.
Yeah.
That's the worst. It's just too much better. You end up with nothing, just time on your hands. The kids are off to school. We send them to pre-kindergarten now even.
Yeah.
Well, what do you do?
Well, you know, my mother, of course, she didn't live in a real small space, but she's always, we've always lived in the city. My mother's been real creative with other things. When she was tired of sewing, she took up cross stitch or whatever, I'm not sure. But I mean, she's always busy.
But she didn't have television.
Yeah, the TV's always on, but she's never sitting down watching
it.
But
not when you were young.
Oh, I was 11 when we got a TV. So, you know,
She grew up before she was infected, right?
My mother, yeah. Yeah. So did my dad, but he seems to be more addicted to it than she is. He's been retired longer, though, too. And you know, there's also that sense of not ever retiring, which is kind of nice, you know, to have that job for the rest of your life.
That's the reason women can take it so much better, retirement so hard on retirement.
It's particularly women who work inside the home, yeah.
It has to do with, I think, being defined by one's work, too,
yeah.
And retirement often for men means, well, then I know it because I don't have it to work.
Yeah, again, you know, I wonder, how can we define ourselves apart from what we do?
Susan, let's go to points 2 and 3.
Okay, good, thank you. Point 2 has to do with what we were just talking about,
yeah,
primarily. So I think we'll go to point 3, which essentially she is talking about work and how our work has affected the earth and how we have affected third world nations by, again, primarily the profit motive, the whole sense of producing is more important than the persons who do the production, as she would, that would be her argument. That we've sort of been dominated, I have a note here, dominated by scientific technological complex. And have, in some ways, been kind of enamored of that, you know, that it's going to solve all of our problems. But we talked a little bit about this the first day, too, about how the production and greed in the Western culture has affected a country like Haiti that no longer has any producible soil. And so they are, you know, in the process of they have to import their basic human needs, food, one of their basic human needs. When we produce things that cannot go back into the earth, one of the arguments, this isn't from her book, this is how I would interpret some of what she was saying. One of the pastors on the Iron Range was saying that the difference between those who work in that kind of a setting and those who work in the rural areas of Minnesota as farmers is that the farmers always have a sense of being in touch with the earth. I mean, they're a part of and they work with it. They can always put back in even though they take out. Those who work mining, taking out, you know, the iron ore is that in that case, they just keep taking out, but they don't put anything back, and they see the earth changing right around them because of what they're taking from it. And that would be what she would say, what Dorothea Zola would be getting at, is that we need perhaps to be going back into a sense of what we're doing, how is that affecting our environment, ecological balance, and also then the peoples of the world who aren't as involved in the production as we are in the Western world. So those are, and I guess I have just a quote. She said, "Through good work, we can further the redeeming transformation of creation, restoring harmony between it and the human community. Once Christ, through his struggle and crucifixion, gained kingship, as the old image would have it, he gave the world back to the control of the working people, the sons and daughters of God. This version of redemption shows clearly how far our contemporary theologizing has moved away from a reconciliatory understanding of both creation and redemption. Mainstream Christianity has reduced the meaning of Christ's salvation to an inward event. It has produced the individual who claims to be saved but who has neither changed nor become an agent of change. It's an interesting observation, at least. The tendency to isolate Christian faith from the social order has meant, among other things, the mainstream theology has failed to address work in the context of creation and redemption. It has ignored the worlds of pain created by a structural organization of our work. It has unconsciously or often cynically obscured our creation as workers in the image of the great artist. And then she said, we still wait for good work. Through good work, we are revealed in our creative empowerment as the children of God. In other words, we ought to be about redeeming the earth, or reconciling ourselves in reconciliation with the earth. That is a part of what it means to be saved, to be a part of Christ, is to be about that redemption ourselves. And I think, and she would say, we can do that, you know. Just being more conscious. At Holden is a wonderful place to kind of get in touch with some of that. The real concern about how many people are on our trails, which is a part of the Forest Service as well, are eating. We eat very low on the food chain. You've probably noticed by the meals. We eat little or no foods that are processed. That have any kind of chemicals in them. We eat very little meat, which is always a source of debate. Part of which I think is economic, but mostly it has to do with the philosophy of food at Holden. And we never throw anything away after the first meal, which is real exciting to me because our leftovers are wonderful. They always look like a new dish. Mm-hmm. But in it, you know, we discover things like did we have that meat dish this week with a little
stew or what did they call it yesterday?
I don't know what he called it.
It was casserole.
A casserole with
they had used. They just dunk everything in. Yeah.
Sausages and stuff in it. Mm-hmm. We had Friday night barbecued Polish. Mm-hmm. That was in our hot dish yesterday. Mm-hmm. Along with some other things from other days.
From the week.
The French toast this morning was the bread.
From the meal last night.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we once had cream of hash brown soup. That's good.
I have to admit that what you're saying are words that would come out of my mouth and what she's saying. However, there's my father here on my shoulder who says, yes, but those miners have to support a family.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and somebody's got to... And the people who make the MX missile have a family to support, and it's easy for me to say. I have a close friend who's a single parent and works at a prison, and who am I to say don't work at that prison because I don't have a son to support? So I think it's important to have ideals and whatnot. It's also important to be sensitive to people who have to live in some real hard realities.
And also to take it one step further and to try to be creative about how we were doing that here a little. I always ask that question too. Mm-hmm. How can we help them? I mean, how can we help to keep them surviving if we do away with the production of MX missiles, for example? Mm-hmm. We have to be responsible to the people who are working there.
And provide alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, can I, as a person who's employed, well, I'm not necessarily employed right now, but, you know, in a job that is not involved in, you know, so I wouldn't have to lose my job as a result of closing down a plant. Don't I have, I mean, I can sit and talk about that, like you're saying, but don't I have a responsibility then to provide something for those people to do? Or do I just expect them to be responsible to quit their jobs because of conscience, perhaps?
My conscience.
Yeah, because of my conscience, right? So, you know, we've got this complex, technological kind of society where you can't just say, put it back into the earth. Mm-hmm. What they are doing in places like the Iron Range is that they're learning how to grow things in the taconite tailings. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to reuse. They have begun to try to reuse the earth that has been, they've just dumped on. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to do that here too. They have artichokes, growing up in the tailings.
Artichokes. That's great.
Yeah, and I guess they're the only ones that, the only kind of thing that can grow in that environment. Well then, now, this is the next part is the part that I didn't get as involved in because I wasn't, I had to pack my suitcase. But the last section.
I need to respond yet to one more thing.
Okay.
You can finish. In fact, I have to chuckle. You said, I just have a quote to share with you. I thought it was a pretty significant quote, and I don't want to let it go by.
Okay.
You talked about how important it is, and we have talked about it, but you went on to talk about the redeeming of the world. And what it does for me is it sends up a red flag in regard to my understanding of Christ as Redeemer. Maybe because I don't know any of you, it's probably safe for me to say, and I probably won't see you again, it's probably safe for me to share with you a bit my own theology or my problem with the notion of Christ as my Redeemer. And I happen to be Roman Catholic, where that is even more important. But the difficulty I have with calling Christ my Redeemer is that it's easy for me to then let Christ do the work, and I don't have to feel like it's my responsibility to redeem myself, anybody else, the world, nature. And that is the difficulty, I believe, when you separate theology or faith or spirituality from the social order or social issues or one's work from the earth or women from men, the home from the workplace, and so on, all those different polarities. And I'm just wondering how we can, as a Christian community or as a people, work on becoming more, these are new words for me, that's why I'm having a hard time saying thought about it. How we can somehow create a form of discussion for this to happen. I don't want to have to feel uncomfortable raising this issue. I'm not uncomfortable now. These words just are not ones I use often. How can we empower people to feel like they are redeemers as well?
As being redeemed.
As being redeemed and as redeemers.
One of the things that I think I hear you saying is that, well, maybe I don't hear you saying, I'm concerned.
Okay.
My question has to do with what is the issue surrounding being redeemed by Christ for you?
Well, the larger issue for me is, why do I need to have somebody redeem me? If I am indeed a child of God in creation, I am a work of art, why do I need someone to redeem me?
What have you done?
What have I done? Yeah. You know, why am I, because Adam and Eve supposedly, you know, were part of original sin, do I need to be redeemed? That's the issue. That's the larger issue, of course. And then further on are the issues of all the different polarities that I mentioned.
So that maybe if you don't need to be redeemed, maybe there are others who don't also.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I'm special.
So that maybe we're not involved in the process of redemption?
That could be, yeah, I didn't say
that. That
could certainly be one of the thoughts. And the other thought is then, I think when we call Christ as the Redeemer, we don't take on responsibility. We don't feel empowered to redeem one another and ourselves for ourselves. An old joke I think of is there was a Catholic and a Lutheran church in town. The Catholic church's roof was leaking, and people got together and said, "Father, fix the roof." And the Lutherans got together, or any Protestant community got together and said, "We better fix the roof, it's leaking." Well, you know, we need to do more of let's fix the roof. you know, it's leaking, and instead of expecting the pastor to do it or somebody that we pay to do it.
Is there a response? Questions?
Well, I think he's saying, how do we as a community do something? Now, maybe you're saying before that, how do we as a community decide what it is we, quote, want or need or something to do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also, how do we as a community go about that? Which I think is one of the reasons for some of my sensitivities on this subject, which I end up saying, well, you know, and I think I said this yesterday, that to me we got a choice. We either can live in a chaotic world, we can live in a largely market system-oriented world with a bunch of limits, mm-hmm. or we can live in a highly dictatorial government structured world, and I don't see in the foreseeable future any fourth option. And as a result, if in my view, then we as a community, as individuals and or community, need to chip away at some places of this imperfect world we're in. And I think it is individuals and community.
One of the fourth options is Holden. I mean, it's a concept like Holden, except that it doesn't, you know, this isn't the perfect option either. But the concept of living in a community where you may have a division of labor in some respects. I mean, you have some people who are more skilled as electricians and some as plumbers or whatever. But where you produce for yourself.
To develop a system of those, but it has its structure and it has its
original
labor.
That's what I'm saying.
And
it's not
has its utilization of resources. So I agree. There's many good things about Holden Village, but it is not a different option. It is a part of this option of the country we live in. It's not a different one.
It could be if it were a self-sufficient place, but it's
can't
not.
Be in the United States.
When the dynamo breaks down, why do you need electricity?
When what?
When the dynamo breaks down, where do you need the repairs?
We have people who do that.
Yeah, but they're going to have to go out and buy the new armature or something.
Yeah, they have to go out and buy the parts. So, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of the concept, the possibility of a community where you could make your own. They do it. They're amazing what they do for parts here. Yeah.
No, as a small community, that's fine.
So, but are you saying that you don't think that would be possible to do?
Well, there are certain areas. It comes from walls and lawns and so forth.
Yeah.
That concept is good. It's kind of a utopia kind of thing. And it's good, but it's for the large numbers of people, I don't think it could work.
Could you do it in your neighborhood?
I think we're so interdependent that in a big city, you don't think.
I think I agree, but I'm trying to be more hopeful.
I lived in a community that was like Holden for 2 years, uh-huh. right in the inner city of Milwaukee, and we came as close to Holden as we could. Mm-hmm. Right, we are part of a larger system. We can't escape from that.
Yeah,
those are true.
So, but it takes a lot of creative energy
and a lot of commitment. Excuse me, you had your hand up.
Oh, on your other question.
Yeah, I'd like to
redemption.
Yeah, right.
I would like to hear what you would say about that, because I think that on the mission field you face there are different tribes that live and people that believe different things, and you have to rather give the same answer to them. But I was wondering how, when you face this all the time, how would you answer this question on redemption?
Well, I guess the part is teaching in the church, I accept that the doctrine of original sin, mm-hmm. and that we are, that is, in spite of ourselves or whatever, we are imperfect, and we are always in need of being remade or renewed, and it is through
they were doing. But it's, I mean, it's not only that, but at the same time, we live in a world and we have to help another. I mean, this is important too. We have to work together, mutually support one another, and reprimand one another sometimes, I suppose, mutual guidance, and then celebrate together. That's probably one of the most important things of all. This, I think, is where I think many cultures, less industrialized, and less industrialized than ours, it's probably a lot easier for them to be able to celebrate many things of life much better than they can. They have time for it, they take time for it. Shouldn't say they have time for it because many of them live on a subsistence level, but they take time for it. It's just a part of it.
I don't want to keep you from moving out of this. In fact, I think I'd like to hear what you have to say now, but maybe I was mostly posing questions and just sharing my own questions.
Yeah.
I don't need the answers at all. I don't have the answer either.
I don't either. Those are questions I struggle with too. I do struggle with the concept of original sin. Yeah. I hadn't until probably within the last 2 years. Never even occurred to me that I could think of it differently.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think of it differently yet, but I'm still, you know, that's a new theological concept that I hadn't been confronted with before. So if I were going to be here longer, when you're here, we could maybe try to sit down and discuss that. The next part, and I'm going to just finish that. She doesn't really delineate a whole lot of differently between working and loving, but at least I can give you the chapter headings so you have a sense of where we're going with this. Sexuality. And alienation. She had a chapter on work and alienation. I capitalized some letters and I don't know where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
This you never were a primary teacher.
That's right. I taught in secondary.
Yeah. You wouldn't have learned the lowercase letters had you been a primary teacher.
And I also didn't learn to write on the board very well.
You do all right. And actually, I was thinking you could have been raised by the nuns because you do very well.
Almost in solidarity. Now I've got myself doing it on purpose.
Something kind of nice about saying I'm not going to do it the way you told
that's
me
right.
to do it.
That's right. I think that's part of the problem. That
that's
I'm
not
still,
a problem. You're saying no.
Well, I've been saying no for a long time, but I'm not sure anymore why. These are the chapters in which she deals with and equates that with being with love. Oh. The whole part about sexuality and alienation. One of the things she says is our needs for meaningful work, self-respect, dignity, and non-competitive social relations have been overtaken by consumerism. She's already made that assumption. Okay. So have the family and our sexual relationships. It is superficial to understand the collapse of traditional values, the crisis of the family, and the celebration of promiscuous sexuality simply as moral issues that a self-declared moral majority can redeem. The collapse of traditional values is the consequence of an economy that extols chain exchange value over use value, profit over people, production over human work, and capital over labor.
Read that one again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lower.
The collapse of traditional value is the consequence of an economy that extols exchange value over use value, profit over people, production over human work, and capital over labor. And she cites the experience of women. Somebody else has done this too. In one of our forums earlier in Winter Community, this was raised about, in the convention, she says, in the conventional nuclear family, man is the producer and woman is the consumer. Okay. The woman therefore becomes the special target and victim of this new type of mass education. She was sold before, meaning, when, you know, in terms of prostitution and being a property, mm-hmm. you know, in the older
slave
understanding,
servant,
slave
yeah.
servant role. And now she too becomes the buyer and adapts herself to the cycle of prostitution. Once the mere object, now she is the agent of the transformation of human needs. And what I remember from the forum we had was that the woman said that what she was struggling with was when she doesn't have anything else to do, she goes out and buys something. Mm. You know? And she goes shopping. She loves to go shopping. And she doesn't need all of those things. But there's just something about... I thought, oh yeah. You know, that if I'm not feeling very good about myself, what do I do sometimes?
Find new clothes.
Buy something new to wear. In my case, I don't do that because I can't find things to wear because I'm so tall and I get frustrated. But I buy something, like when I had in my home, I'd buy something for the house. New curtains. Or a gadget. Or something. And I'd tell myself I needed it.
But that may come, though, from not from the old marketplace. I mean, I think many centuries of women brought the produce to market and they bartered, and
yeah.
that was an excitement. And
mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. They
yeah.
have to go to the marketplace to get excitement.
The farmer's market.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the farmer's market. Oh, yeah.
Right. They got this and this and this.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
The stores sort of take the place of the market, except they're not the kind of interpersonal exchange.
Yeah. Exchange is far better.
But there's something, and I do the same thing, but I do it at thrift shops, and there's something really fun and creative for me about just picking through and finding a wonderful deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that still goes then.
I almost bought that German chocolate ice cream last night because I had to cry. How much you get eating German chocolate ice cream? I didn't find them.
Yeah. And I think that's true. But and she would say though that you know, that's great. I love that. Because we think we're gonna get it for less.
Yeah.
It suddenly
and it helps us salvage too. You
yeah.
rationalize it that way
yeah,
too.
Right.
You rationalize the thrift store thing, I'm helping a good cause. Even if I take this home and don't use it.
How many times have we sold an art garage sale what we bought at another
right.
time?
Right, right, right. There's something about supporting a cause, but it goes deeper than
yeah.
that for me.
That's what you're saying.
It
Can
goes,
you develop that further?
Yeah. That, well, she uses the language of dream, wish, and hope plays an important role in our lives. You know, there's a whole sense about, and that is important for us to have dreams, to have hope, to have vision. But we get played with ads, you know, advertising, and you know, it's all materialistic, and it comes down to individualistic kinds of needs and profit. You know, we are somewhat affected
quite often affected. We think what we need is, we're told what we need mm-hmm. by our advertising, and we succumb to that. Mm-hmm. Not in all cases. I think it depends on what it is, you know, what, I think that the half price ice cream concept was probably, you know, that was one way to sell this old ice cream. Part of that has to do with the fact that the people who are selling the ice cream in our shop feel kind of guilty about even selling ice cream that's old, older, you know, that maybe won't taste quite as fresh as the new stuff. I don't know. I've never asked them that, but they want to get rid of it, and we have to pay for it. You know, we don't make a profit on the ice cream anyway, so.
I think it's interesting to me that I was guessing that you people would feel guilty if you charged enough for the ice cream to make money.
Yeah, but we don't make. We have to pay for the tax and yeah. and the
supplies.
Well, we have to. Yeah, but we also have the shipping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know that has to be added on to, mm-hmm. and that's where the price is going. But we don't. It's all
no profit.
No profit. Right.
What's fascinating to
our
me.
Offering also goes out of the village at our worship services. None of it is kept here to keep things going. And so, you know,
to a third world cause or
yeah, oh, interesting
organization within the church.
Would you like to hear how we decided where
sure.
the offering went
sure.
for the last 4 weeks? Or no, it's going to be now. I think it'll be going to African food relief or South African issues. I'm not sure for the summer months. But as a winter community, we were to make decisions about how we wanted this offering to be used. We had no trouble, and we would do it by consensus. We had no trouble with the first half of the offering. That went to African, Ethiopian hunger relief. And it went through Canada, because the Canadian government is matching the monies. Some Canadian organization is matching the monies, and so we give our offering to this Lutheran congregation in Canada, who then gives it to
this organization that matches it.
Yeah, so it doubles. Okay, so well, I don't think it's no, it isn't Lutheran
no.
in our case, but so that's half the offering. But then we had all these other agencies that people were suggesting. One of which is Hutches in Wenatchee, which is a place for transient males, primarily, who kind of come in and out and don't have any place to go and no place to eat. And, you know. Okay. Then there's the Women's Center in Wenatchee that also does that in some ways for women, but teaches classes on, offer courses and things and other resources, emergency food and all those kinds of things. We have the Center for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in Wenatchee, which deals primarily with education and counseling of women and children and occasional men who come in, but not very often, who are victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. Then we had the Community Food Shelf in Maquoketa, Iowa. And then we had the suggestion for the Defense Fund, Sanctuary Defense Fund, for those persons who are providing sanctuary for Salvadoran and Nicaraguan refugees who are then breaking the law and thus need money to help with defense. Well, we couldn't decide of those five which one was going to get the other half. So the decision was 40% will go to the Women's Center in Wenatchee, 40% will go to the Salvadoran Defense, or the Sanctuary Defense Fund, and the other 20% will be divided between the Maquoketa Hutches, because we had been supporting Hutches, not supporting, but giving to Hutches over the year twice before. So we thought we'd just let others in Wenatchee know that we care about them too. Hutches, and then the Center for Domestic Violence.
Okay. A lot of work, but.
Yeah, it took three community meetings to do that.
What amount of money are we talking about?
Pardon me?
What amount of money are we talking about?
We don't know. I think probably total money would probably be like $600 or $700.
Yeah.
So that's not too bad.
No.
That's the total amount of
6 weeks of offering.
Six Sundays?
Yeah, six Sundays.
possibly. It may not be that high. I'm not sure.
$600.
Yeah.
And what?
Divided in half.
How many?
Well, 70 people. We had youth weekends the last three weekends. Of course, they're not terribly generous because they're not used to being responsible, you know, in terms of giving offering. I mean, that isn't something, that's something we learn, I think, when we start making more money. I don't know why we learn it later. But anyway, mostly the winter community, staff, people who worked here, not guests.
Sexuality in the Illinois Nation, I want to hear about
that. All right, all right.
Before we end.
Okay. So it has, okay, so a part, she talks about the consumerism in that, in the, our relationship to what we need versus what we are told we need. She says, one of the things that you said too is that we need somebody to love us or someone to love. Mm-hmm. And we have two things that are pulling at us in terms of how that happens in this society. One is the, she calls it the old patriarch who says, I lost that part. She says, love has two enemies. One is an old patriarch, the other a stylish young man. Okay. The old man prefaces everything he has to say with, thou shalt not. He loves to be in control of all things, especially women. He stands for traditional religious and familial values, speaking out against premarital sex, reproductive rights, and homosexuality. He tries to enforce his will through legal and extra-legal regulations. He is repressive and coercive as a father or as the head of a church board. The neurotic conflict he usually engenders is the Oedipal conflict, because the new enemy of love is choose, is to choose these forms of coercion, it is more difficult to detect his equally compulsory features. The new enemy assures us that sex is a commodity and not sin, a word he would not allow to pass over his lips. He rejects moralism. His repression of our need for relationship works through consumerism. He exploits our feelings but does not oppress them. He trivializes sexual relationships and makes sex into a commodity. The neurotic or pathological conflict he produces is narcissism. And so she says, you know, the old is, anybody who's in, who's been involved in a lot of counseling knows how the old style, the old patriarch, has affected the lives of a lot of people. But we also have this new person who is also, and then she uses the whole thing about, she does talk about how during the early years of the women's movement, and when you dealt with the whole question of sexuality and sex, primarily genital sex, was that women were free to do what the men had always assumed they were free to do, and that that was, that's somewhat damaging, and that that was, that was laid on us. What we, what we did was we just simply assumed, as women, the male model, which we never liked in the first place. You know, the whole double standard concept of it's okay for me, but it's not okay for you. And we're saying, well, it's going to be okay for me. But it was never okay for him in the first place. You see. And that we have, because of the, all of, Christer Stendahl said once that the only sin that the United States, or the only commandment that the United States has is the sixth one. The only one we care about is the sixth one, which is thou shalt not commit adultery. Seems, you know, because they were asking him a question about the sexual mores of people in Sweden, which is where he's from. And he'd been there, and he said that was the only question they had to ask him. Now, they didn't care about all the other things that are going on in Sweden, all the other problems and maybe issues of you know, other, the other nine commandments that are also affected. So he said, probably the only reason, we don't know how to deal with ourselves as sexual beings. And part of that is because of all the stimuli that are, that's out there that keeps telling us this is the right way, this is the right way.
And the emphasis on it as a major part of life.
Yeah, exactly.
sex as a major part. Not sexuality is a major part of life. Sexuality is what determines who we are as male and female. And that sexuality was a part of the creation. We were created in the image of God, male and female. He created them. There are, she says, we are threatened by the old and the new enemies of love, who sometimes form a strange alliance. And this part, I think, hopefully I won't read it too fast. The repression of the old culture was based on nature and a seemingly natural understanding of human sexuality that made procreation its aim. And that has been the understanding of why two people get married, or it was earlier. It's not so much anymore. But the whole biblical understanding of sex and sexuality is different from our understanding of it today. And that the primary reason why a man took a wife was simply so that they could have sons and further the family line. There are not a lot that I can find in terms of just male-female relationships about people getting married simply for love.
They never even met each other before they were married.
That's right. Yeah. And so because of the concept of procreation, there had to be restrictions on that relationship. And one of the things, she doesn't say this because it's something that comes out of a study on sexuality, is that the women, or that they didn't understand the woman as having any uterus or ovaries or what's the other?
Fallopian tubes.
You know, I mean, that there was no process, that she was simply the vessel into which the man put his sperm. And it was, the baby grew, and they knew the woman, the baby grew in the woman, but they didn't know that she participated in the formation of the sex of the baby, you know, or the color of the hair. And there wasn't any genetic work done then. So that's why women had to be so protected from other relationships with men, as when they were property. This is biblical, not present, because they were, you know, it could be another man's seed growing in that woman. We certainly don't want that to happen. So, sex initially, I think, was understood as not having anything to do with feelings or relationship as much as it had to do with family. But that has changed, thank goodness. It hasn't changed. You're not saying it's changed.
It's changed for me.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You talk about we understand differently now. My daughter made an interesting comment the other day. She's just begun work as a public health nurse.
Mm.
And she visits these young people. They haven't a clue. They haven't the slightest clue what goes about, why they gave birth to a child.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Totally ignorant. I can't believe it. She has to explain the whole thing. Not only just, you know, how to feed a child, but they don't even understand why she had what the process was.
What an incredible surprise to suddenly be pregnant and not know why.
Or what, how to raise a child, or
yeah.
It goes on your body.
I would agree. So, maybe we don't know anymore today.
This, on the other hand, then, is maybe one reason why cultures through the ages, through millenniums, it's a way of protecting themselves, too, because we're as stupid as we were in many respects thousands of years ago.
Sure.
The old man in Ecclesiastes, there's something true, but there's nothing new.
That's a good point.
I had an argument the other night discussion with Elmer. Maybe we didn't understand each other, but there's something about understanding, you know, our faith and our culture. They work hand in hand. I feel very strong about that, and especially having lived in other cultures and see how they operate. And then go back and look and read the Old Testament times and how similar sometimes, well, what we look at, you know, how it just, the mission, yeah, there's so much, there is an unfathomable amount of wisdom in these cultures.
Yeah.
And I am convinced yet, somebody will have to Lutheranize me or something. And then he said, you know, well, to the effect that Luther, you know, scripture, sola fide, I don't even know what it is.
Sola fide?
Everything is based on scripture. He said, well, this is true, but I still think that the wisdom of our culture all blends in with it. And what is much of the Old Testament except the collective wisdom of people, of tribes,
culture didn't come out of scripture. Scripture came out of culture.
Absolutely.
Both old and new.
And not just Jewish culture, because Jewish culture assimilated an awful lot. Okay. Although they were unique themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was unique culture. I'd sure like to have a chance that we go around that for a while on the work culture and work together with it, you know, in affirming and strengthening and lightening up there.
What are her prescriptions for less alienation in the present culture due to sexuality changes?
Okay. Well, she talks about redefining our sexuality. How do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And she quotes from James Nelson, who wrote a book called Embodiment, which is a book on, it's a wonderful book on human sexuality. What she said, sexuality is a sign, a symbol, and a means of our call to communication and communion. The mystery of our sexuality is the mystery of our need to reach out to embrace others both physically and spiritually. Sexuality thus expresses God's intention that we find our authentic humanness in relationship. She said, and this is the part that was sort of exciting in terms of, and then she says, any long-term relationship, there's a need for a common project. Something the lovers want to accomplish in their world, such as building a house, tilling a garden, doing social work in an impoverished neighborhood, running a business, or to name the most traditional but by no means universal project, raising a family. This is true for all intimate relationships. That when you are in an intimate relationship, it isn't simply to fulfill your own needs. But it's when your needs are being fulfilled because of that relationship, then you're so free to do other things. And that I think I really want to incorporate into my ministry in working with couples. I keep trying.
That
but it's that whole
powerful
sense.
Right,
yeah, you bet it is.
It was just a magazine article. Very powerful.
Yeah.
I read that same concept in a magazine article.
It is so powerful. It says that, you know, I'm not in this just for what I'm going to get out of it. But I'm in it because, you know, we're in relationships so that we take care of a basic human need, which is to be intimately involved with another human being. And what that does then is frees us from
to co-create,
to be involved, to be persons who move out and do. That is one of the reasons for being married men, is
and
to have,
work.
Yeah, and to
work.
Yeah, right. Hmm. And interesting.
Well, it's a good concept because you bring in two people to work cooperatively with ideas rather than singly, and therefore it's greater force in the accomplishment of the project.
The other thing she talks about is trust. That's the, you know, trust is so important in any relationship, in any
understanding of who we are. You know, we learn to trust God. We learn to trust each other. And it is who we are as sexual human beings that helps us and sometimes hinders us in terms of how we relate and learn to trust. But we need to learn to trust before we can move out to do the kinds of things that need to be done in the world. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And trust must be developed at an early age in children.
Mm-hmm.
You must be a primary school teacher.
I think she is.
That's great.
She says the four dimensions of sexuality are wholeness, trust, ecstasy, and solidarity.
What are they?
Wholeness. Wholeness, trust, ecstasy, and solidarity.
These are four what?
Dimensions of sexuality.
Blueberry.
Yeah. Okay. She says wholeness is to love is to be whole. There, it is a multidimensional. It is and it's an integration of our physical potencies. Psychical, intellectual, aesthetical, emotional, and spiritual. Trust. To love is to be at home. That involves consolation, reliability, regressive drives, and vulnerability.
I'm sure she expresses
this, you know, more specifically. I'm just going over the diagram, but because I'm trying to do to get mm-hmm. to the hope yeah, part. Okay. To love is to lose one. This is ecstasy. To love is to lose oneself. Is to delight in being alive. Is to have a mutuality, progressive drives, and self-transcendence. Ecstasy is what gets us out of ourselves. And solidarity is to know. To love is to know that love and justice are inseparable. That private and public are inseparable. That relatedness to others is a part of knowing, and there is a political dimension of eros and agape.
Of what?
Eros and agape. Oh. And I'm not sure that you'd have to almost read the book to get a broader sense of what she's saying.
And Susan measured that by a culture of narcissism, and none of those.
Right.
None of those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's narcissism?
Remember, Narcissus is, and if I got this, is a Greek myth about a young man who was extremely attractive, wasn't he?
Right.
Okay.
Well,
I thought he was. Now, was he the god? Was he a god? Or was the female gods? Anyway, he was so enamored with himself that he didn't have time to be in relationship all these others. He only used people for his own benefit. So they put a curse on him where he stood over this pool and he could only look at himself. And he fell in and drowned. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Right. Well, because he couldn't get enough of himself. He couldn't eat and sleep. I guess that's probably what it is. And he died. And that's where we get this narcissism. Is that love for self, you know, which excludes everyone else.
And then they cut off his head.
Oh, okay.
And down the stream, and then all these others gathered up and hit it, and they couldn't stand it. And they had to put the head back with the body and bury it together, because they couldn't stand it. That was beautiful creature.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I probably should have let you tell the whole story.
I think it's important to make a difference, though, between self-love, which is a very important thing.
Yes. Right.
It is.
One of her closing quotes on wholeness and solidarity before she gets to created for hope. She says, "A reflection on our need for love, for giving and receiving love, reaches a point where it becomes necessary to talk about God as the one who needs us, all of us. Unconditionally. God needs our growing capacity to love to continue creation. In the socio-political struggle against death, which rules in hunger, exploitation, and war,
God will make use of all our passions and our undivided love for life.
Yeah, and it's process theology.
Yeah. It's also very hard for me sometimes to consider, think of God needing me. I mean, I'm still not there yet, but I love what she says. It's just that I'm not.
Certainly, it's been
changed
from original sin.
Yeah. And then finally, the last part has to do with some of the questions that were raised before. The whole thing that we can't, you know, not to live hopelessly, but to consider the possibilities as you were expressing, you know, hey, it isn't always like that. It isn't like what, in your community, what I've experienced. And what I heard your community being is one of a real potential, especially your church. If all churches could, where people could be participants within that congregation equally, not based on status or anything else. So she ends with a real hopeful kind of, you know, we have no, as Christians, we really have no other way to live except in hope. To be in despair is to live in sin. Which takes us back to the beginning of her book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like what you said about that because it brought back a memory that I had a thought of for a long time when you said that God needs us to love.
Yeah.
What did you say? And, oh, that president of our church body, oh, maybe back in the 50s, when you start with A, once he wrote that. Oh, no, I heard him speak, and he said that, why were we created? Uh-huh. That was his theme, and he said we were created because God needed a family to love and to love him.
Who was that? Mm-hmm. Is that Ahlstrom? Are you Swedish background?
No,
or
it's...
Are you Lutheran, first of all?
Yes, I'm ALC. But this is when he was president, maybe in the 50s, that I heard him speak.
Okay, but what do you remember what denomination you were prior to the ALC?
When did we become ALC?
60.
Really?
Were you Norwegian?
Yes. Norwegian.
Was it Schutz?
No, it was before.
Schutz?
Was it before him?
Huh. Boy, I like that. I wonder. That's what she's been saying.
Exactly what she's saying.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, here we go. There's nothing new. Oh, just the quote. The new human being is born in the resurrection of Christ. He and she are empowered to fight death and those who hold us under the sway of death. The new human being in Christ is a resistor, a revolutionary. She knows that for which she lives and gives her life. He is a fighter for the city of God. The new human being is a loving being who participates in three forms of creation as co-creator. He and she are committed to the renewal of the earth, to our liberation from bondage, and to resistance against death and all powers of death. The third creation is as unfinished as the other two. All three creations continue still.
And that's a response to my point before, in looking at a more broader definition of redemption.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is.
It's a wonderful book, and I've really rushed through it. Soelle. Well, it may even come in before you leave. Yeah.
There's another book by her in the library.
Yes, there are lots of books here.
Oh, that is in our library or in our bookstore.
Yeah, but not that book isn't. But there's others by the same author.
Well,
this book is registered in the library. There's a card catalog.
Uh huh. But I think somebody has it checked out. Yeah.
Probably that one.
Well, thank you for being.
Thank you for guiding us through this course.
It
wasn't an easy book to interpret, really.
No,
yeah,
and I knew it doing this.
No,
oh, you were. Oh, you were wonderful. You really were. I appreciated all the struggles and stuff with this. And this is a new thing for me to do, too.
Are you doing it again?
Yeah, but I think when Elmer talked to me about doing some things, he said 5 sessions, so maybe it would be like a whole week.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have, if I weren't going to this convention, I would have had at least 4 days this week. So, but it's soon time for lunch, and you may want to, I don't know what you want to do before that. What day is it?
Is it Thursday?
It's Thursday.
Oh, okay. We have you on no concept.
I know it.
I think we should give a round of applause.
Thank you.
Send her off on her way.